Welcome to Why We Marathon, a podcast diving into the deep motivating factors for why people choose to run marathon races. I'm your host, Alex Ellman. Today we have a legend joining us. I'm really excited for this interview. Please welcome Jack Foltz, the winner of the 1976 Boston Marathon. Thanks for joining us today, Jack. How are you?
Alex, I'm doing very well, thanks. And thanks a million for having me. Great to be here.
Definitely. Great to have you, absolute running legend on the show. You know, your story, I think, is one of the better known marathon stories out there. So I'm excited to tell it to everyone. Now, just a few questions to get out of the way. You know, I love to see where marathon runners are in life and where they came from. How old are you and what's your current day job?
Well, I'm old enough to know better. I tell some people that, but I'm 72 now. So getting up there in age, and but you know, 72 years young, I like to think, and still moving. You know, as we've all heard the expression, age is an attitude. So and just a number. So I like to think my best years are still ahead of me, not necessarily my running years, but whatever other years I may have available to me. So then my day job is, you know, pretty much trying to complete my to-do list every day, which continues to expand way out ahead of me. But in reality, I work with a handful of individual runners that I train on a regular basis. And then I'm a contract employee for the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute here in Boston and the fundraising end. So I'm the training advisor for all the running programs at Dana-Farber. And my wife is actually the director of the entire program. And so we have about four or five teams. The Boston Marathon is our largest, most predominant team. We have almost 500 runners. Prior to COVID, 2020, when everything got thrown under the rug, but in 2019 and prior to that, our team was comprised of about 500 runners. Boston Athletic Association, that hosts the marathon, also puts on a half marathon as well as some other races in the fall. Is their half marathon, and Dana-Farber is actually one of the sponsors of that, key sponsors. So we have a 500 runner team. Running the half marathon. We have 300 runners run the Falmouth Road Race on a fundraising team. So between those three and several others, collectively, we raise a lot of money for research, and some of it goes to patient care at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute every year. So those races are spread out around the year. So those all keep me busy as well. So that's what you would call my day job.
Amazing. And I mean, that's a great cause. I just interviewed another guest who also runs on that team. And, you know, that Dana-Farber Institute does some of the best cancer research in the world. So can't thank you enough. You know, I've been someone personally impacted by cancer, both through my mother and my grandfather. And, you know, it's clearly something that, you know, hopefully we'll tackle in our lifetime. And if not, we're sort of laying the groundwork for the next one. So I really appreciate that. Now let's take it back.
Our mantra, by the way, you mentioned that. Let me just throw in, if I may,
please.
That our tagline is a world without cancer. So we all have that same ultimate goal. So, and we just continue to pursue that.
I love that. And so, yeah, anyway. I think that's a great point about the running community. It's, you know, a lot of people are out there fundraising for important causes and bringing awareness to important issues like the cancer research at the Dana-Farber Institute. So hats off to you and all those runners and to your wife as well. We might have to have her on the podcast as another guest too.
There you go. She'd love it.
Awesome. So now let's go back in time a little bit here. You know, before we even get to Boston, what was your very first marathon race?
Well, I think I don't know if I alluded to it when you and I were chatting before we started podcasting, but it was 50 years ago last month, interestingly enough. So it's sort of a coincidence that you'd be asking me that question now. And I was down in the Washington, D.C. area. I was in the Coast Guard there initially, and I got into the road running program. I was a runner in high school and played some other sports as well. And then I was a walk-on in college, 2 years at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And that was my first cross-country experience and therefore sort of distance running, where we'd be running 40, 50 miles a week or something. And that was it. Then transferring schools back east, it was 1969. I got caught up in the draft. It was during the Vietnam War. I was able to get into the Coast Guard and serve 4 years. For my service. Yeah, thanks. And so I was in the Coast Guard and I met some of the local road runners. I was fortunate that the DC area, this is back in 1969-70, road running was nothing like what it is today. Frank Shorter was unknown. He was still a student at Yale University. No one knew who Bill Rogers was. He was at Wesleyan University, right? We were just college Joe Schmoes. So they, of course, with their successes, ushered in the whole initial running boom in the United States and then expanded to the world. But so I was just doing my running and I met these local runners and they had road races every weekend. And so I would kept going to these races. Finally, in late fall, they said all the races started getting longer every weekend. And I said, what's going on? They said, well, next February, everybody wants to build up and be ready to run the Washington Birthday Marathon. Back then, we celebrated Washington and Lincoln's birthday separately. Now it's just President's Weekend. That's just to talk about a different era. So anyway, I prepared for that Washington Birthday Marathon in February of 1971. And I ran that and I had some success there. Worked out very well. So I was excited. I knew most of the people in the race anyway. Some guys came in from out of town to really present a challenge, but it worked out well. So 2 months later, I came up and ran my first Boston Marathon that year as well, and my second overall marathon. So,
wow. And now let's just go back a step. So you were sort of just surrounded by a lot of people that were running a lot, and that's sort of what prompted you to sign up for that first race, or what really was that, you know, motivating factor, but you know, to get your name on that Washington Birthday Marathon day?
Yeah, no, it was the people I was running these weekend road races with. They all started talking about, and they had been doing this for years, and I was new to the scene. I was in my first year there, and they were the ones that, and I asked them, why are the road races getting longer and longer? And then I realized, and they told me, of course, that we're all preparing for the Washington Birthday Marathon in February. So in late fall, October, November, December, these road races went from 8 miles to 12 miles to 15, and then finally a 20 miler sometime in January, and then maybe 3 weeks off, and then was the marathon. Everybody, of course, didn't run it, but a lot of the people who were into the longer distances did. And I knew about the marathon. I knew what the length of the distance was. It was 26.2 miles, but I had never really run that far, and I certainly never did in training. I think you had asked me once before, you know, how far had I run prior to the marathon, or what did I learn when I ran the marathon? I learned that I could run that far because I never had prior to that. So that was my first marathon experience. And as I say, I had some success. I was able to win that race. And then I came up and ran Boston year.
All right, let's go back a step. You won the Washington Birthday Marathon?
I did. Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Wow. What was your time then?
I was back then, you know, 220 was a big landmark in marathoning back then, and 230 was sort of a sub landmark, and I ran 229.58. So
amazing.
I just nipped under that 230 mark.
And what was the course like for that Washington Birthday one? Is that similar to the Marine Corps Marathon now, or totally different?
No, it's significantly different. As a matter of fact, back then they didn't even block off the traffic from the roads. So we were out kind of battling the traffic. I mean, they would have guards holding up intersections, and none of us ever got stopped at any intersections. But it was north of D.C. It was in Beltsville, Maryland, which is a suburb of D.C. And so we were, two big loops. And I remember warming up out in the last segment of one of the loops with about 3 miles to go was the area that we happened to be warming up in before we ran over to the starting line. And I remember making a mental note to myself, okay, right here is about the 23 mile mark, something like that. This will be a good spot for me to make my move. And I was just running strides back and forth, getting ready, getting warmed up for the start of the race. And then we ran the race, and about the 20 mile mark, I started running into problems, and I had to drop off the lead pack. There was myself and several other runners. I had to drop off and let them go, thinking, oh my goodness, this is it. I'm not going to be able to stay with them. I backed off, my legs recovered. I think I got some fluids in me and started to recover and started going again. And boom, I hit that 23 mile mark where I had sort of subconsciously told myself, this is where I'm going to make my move. And I wasn't even aware of it then not until after the race. I realized, wow, that was actually where I must have subconsciously sort of hypnotized myself to the idea that I'm going to start making a move at this point, because I did. And took the lead at about 25 mile mark past a guy who was a silver medalist in the Pan Am Games back in 67. So he'd been brought in as sort of as a ringer. So I felt pretty good to catch him and nail him. But it turned on some lights as well by virtue of winning that race, and all of a sudden I declared to myself, okay, I am now officially a marathoner.
Right. Definitely. And, I mean, after winning one, I think you're officially a marathoner for sure. I think once you finish one, you are, but that's amazing. So what sort of changed, you know, in your mentality or something you learned about yourself either at that mile 23 marker or after that race?
Well, as I said before, one thing I definitely learned was that I can run that far and run it successfully relative to other people who were doing it. So, and I really wasn't sure going into the race. I mean, I thought I'd be competitive because I was in the shorter races leading up to this race with all the local runners. I thought I could hold my own with the majority of them, but you never really know. And there's anything over the 20-mile mark, you know, there's a lot more unknowns thrown into the mix. So you never really know until you go through it. And so there was a lot of confirmation for myself that I belonged, that I could run with, especially when that guy from the outside who had a real credential in the marathon, and it was him and me battling out over the last mile. So it really boosted my confidence. And that's critically important in anything that we do, right? You've got to believe that you can do it sometimes before you actually do it.
You know, there's definitely
line in the one of the U2 songs, you've got to, we used to think you have to see it to believe it. And they say, you have to believe it to see it.
So yeah.
That's kind of goes point. Both ways.
Definitely does. And especially, you know, I think when you're running marathons, it's all mental. You got to believe you could finish it, even if you don't think your body can. You know, it's all mental, as I say, and those mental walls that you have to overcome are critical to marathon racing. So how many marathons have you run since Washington that day?
Well, that was my first of about 45 marathons, you know, give or take one or two, I guess, you know, and 45. That was over a 30-year span. And we had mentioned before, you know, that to some people, to people who just are starting out, you've run three so far. So 45 seems like a lot, but we both know that there are a lot of people, not necessarily a lot of people, but people out there who have run hundreds of marathons. And that's a bit extreme. I think if I had still stayed completely healthy, I might be getting up into that range, but I haven't run a marathon in the last 20 years. And for about 5 or 8 years, I worked for the Boston Marathon. In those years, I couldn't run Boston most of those years because I was busy on marathon weekend. And so that took a lot of opportunity out of my way. And I think I probably would have run more marathons had it not been for that, and had it not been for some injuries that I sustained. And then once I developed some arthritis in my hip in the year 2000, I pretty much shut down the idea of it. I maybe could have run some marathons, but I couldn't really do effective training for long periods of time on that. So I gave up the ghost on that.
Tough on your hips for sure. So I got to ask, which was your favorite marathon?
Well, I gotta say Boston.
All right. Yeah, let's dive in there then.
Okay.
So for our listeners out there who don't know, Jack won the 1976 Boston Marathon, which they call the Run of the Hoses, hottest marathon on record in Boston. I believe it was 100 degrees that day, Jack.
Well, there's always still some question about that. It was 96. it was the official temperature at the starting line, and back then the race started at noontime. They've since moved the start time back two hours for the elite men at 10 o'clock, and the women start even before then. But, you know, if it's going to be hot at noon to two, it's going to be hot 10 to 12 too, you know, maybe, you know, give or take 5 to 10 degrees. But back then it was just crazy. And it was 96 at the noontime start, as I say, and it stayed that hot all the way until I got to the top of Heartbreak Hill, which is about the 21 mile mark. And then interestingly enough, then the terrain goes back downhill all the way into the coast, into Boston proper and the shoreline. And there was a sea breeze coming in at that time. And I still remember distinctly now that I'm relaying this, recounting the event to you, that people were yelling, you know, because they were getting radio reports that there was a cool sea breeze coming in. And sure enough, it did. The temperature literally dropped to 78 degrees. So, which is still warm by marathon standards, but relative to what we had been in, and the air was much drier as well. And it was just the timing of it was perfect, because now I'm in the last 6 miles of the marathon. They called it the Run for the Hoses. They put a sign up on the lead press bus that said, "Hose the runners." And, you know, the marathon goes through predominantly residential sections in the first seven towns that it runs through of the eight. And so people are coming out with their garden hoses, hosing everybody down, and I'm running zigzagging. You know, I'd probably run 27 miles zigzagging between curbs and under these garden hoses. And but the last 5 or 6 miles, there weren't nearly as many of those out there. People just didn't have lawns to water, so there were no garden hoses. But fortunately, because of that drop in temperature and stuff, so the timing of it was perfect for me. I'd started a little more modestly. I just ran even pace the whole way. You know, all the guys that I was, I don't even know if I was maybe in the top 100 at the first mile mark. I mean, we were still all packed together. I could still see the leaders, but there were a lot of people there, and most of them just went out too fast, which is what the most common mistake marathoners make even to this day, is they go out too fast.
Definitely. Now, one quick question. I'm just curious, picturing, you know, I've only run marathons since 2019, so I'm used to a course that has, you know, aid stations every mile or two. What was sort of the scene like there? You're saying you're going, you know, zigzagging for hoses there. How about just hydration and nutrition on a hot day like that? What did you do?
They were pretty much non-existent back then. Same as timing systems. There were no timing systems. You didn't know where you were on vis-a-vis time on the course. There were no clocks out there every mile, every 5K telling you where you were. We also didn't have digital watches. So you know, you might wear an analog watch, wrist watch, or something if you wanted to check your time, but it didn't do you any good because there were no mileage markers on the course, at least not at Boston, and probably not at most other marathons either, and there weren't that many back then. But you just didn't know where you were vis-a-vis distance, other than what they had. The BAA put a big road sign right in the middle of the road. It was a big triangular sign, international orange, and it told you not how far you had run, but how far you had to go. And there are 8 towns in the Boston Marathon. Starts in Hopkinton, goes through Ashland, Framingham, Natick, Wellesley, Newton, Brookline, and Boston. And each of those towns, right in the center, they would put one of these big old signs. And this was just part of the tradition. They did it for, you know, 80 years up to that point. The 1976 was the 80th running. And it would tell you not how far you had run, but how far you had to go. So you could do the math from that. So at the 10-mile mark, the sign said 16 2/3 miles to go. So even if you looked at your watch and tried to calculate the time, you know, you'd spend all your cognition trying to do the math. And so you just kind of, you know, you ran and tried and paced yourself according to what your training was and your sense of how far you had to go and let it all out. So it was a different reality back then, no doubt about it. But and there also, as I say, almost no water stops. And so the people were out with their garden hoses and the kids would be handing you cups of water. There were a few, you know, the YMCA, I think, had set up a few card tables and stuff. I don't actually remember them. I may have grabbed something off one of them, but I honestly don't remember them. But I do very distinctly remember all the garden hoses, little kids running out, handing you slices of orange and stuff. So certainly took all of that. But by today's standards, you couldn't even imagine running a marathon like that.
I couldn't. That's just unbelievable, honestly. I feel like sheer will and determination and sort of that can-do spirit of both marathon runners and also the time, you know, and the time, you know, that you grew up in and the, you know, sort of those surroundings in Boston that day. I am curious, you know, 1976, you know, any sort of patriotism on that day, you know, sort of celebrating, what was that, 200 years of America at that point?
Well, it was, the bicentennial year. And that was, a lot was made of that it was the bicentennial year. And therefore, it wasn't the bicentennial marathon per se, but they played that up and tapped into that a lot. It was good for a little bit of additional press type stuff.
Definitely, a little promotional.
That was kind of the extent of that, yeah. But when I went back to D.C. and I, you know, the Olympic trials, the reason I ran Boston was to get an Olympic trials qualifying time. And I had tried earlier in the year and wasn't because I wasn't fit enough to do it. I had to run a sub 220 to meet the A standard or a sub 223 to meet the B standard. I had never run that fast yet, but I had been away from marathoning from 73 to 76 when I was in school at Georgetown. And I was on the running track and cross country and getting my speed up. And so I had all the confidence that I could run a qualifying time for the Olympic trials in 76 being an Olympic year. And I was graduating that year as well. So that was my primary reason for running Boston that year. As I said, I had run it 3 times before, 71, 2, and 3. So I knew the course, I knew what it was all about, but the Boston being in April, the Olympic trials was in early June. So that's only 6 weeks away. And I knew if I was running well enough and had any, even an outside shot of making the Olympic team, I needed to go into that trials race fresh because only the top three go. And we had Frank Shorter coming back from winning 72. We had Bill Rogers, who won Boston in 75, set the American record. So those two were pretty much a shoe-in if they were healthy to make the team. So there was only one other spot. Anyway, the point being, I didn't want to run Boston that year. I had hoped to qualify beforehand, but it didn't happen. And so there I was at Boston. So, talk about dumb luck.
Seriously.
Timing being everything. So
amazing. And, I think in Boston especially. Oh, is this the medal?
That's
wow.
The medal, yeah.
That is incredible. So for all of our listeners out there, we'll share this in the blog post afterwards on whywemarathon.com. But Jack has a beautiful medal that is definitely a keepsake. And that's pretty special. I mean, not too many people have that, right?
Not too many.
Yep. So tell me, I'm actually curious, you've the Boston Marathon, right? The holy grail of marathons. It seems like everyone wants to do it. Everyone wants to qualify for it. You won it. What was that feeling like being on the podium and sort of afterwards, becoming the winner of the 1976 Boston Marathon? What was going through your heart, your mind, and just sort of, how did that change your personality afterwards?
Well, it's interesting. I like to think it didn't, but it did shed light on a lot of different things, I think, about life. Certainly for me, it was a dream come true. From my first marathon in 71, which I described a little earlier, and then I came up and ran Boston, and now all the runners that I was running with, those who were running marathons, again, as you say, then Boston was the holy grail, as it still is today. There are a lot of other big races now, Chicago, New York, Berlin, the six world majors and all that. And but Boston was really the creme de la creme then. And so it was a dream come true to actually win it. The first time I ran, I finished 12th. The next two times I ran, I didn't run as well, didn't place as high. And so the idea of possibly winning it was still a dream. You're out there doing this training and you're running 100 miles a week and you train. And you have these dreams, God, what would it be like to actually win the race? And so when I got there, I was supremely confident I was going to finish in the top 10. But as I mentioned earlier, my goal was to get my qualifying time. And that was more important to me than where I finished place-wise at the time. So I found myself in a unique situation of truly hoping that my opponents would run as fast as they possibly could too, to run the best race they could, to help pull me along to get my qualifying time. And in the process of doing that, and I realized it really after the fact, that in the process of doing this, in my mind, it made them my allies rather than my enemies, my opponents, and eliminated a lot, if not all, of that competition anxiety that we typically encounter when we go into competitive events, when we have an opponent who we think can beat us, and they're a perceived threat. And when the mind perceives a threat, it elicits the fight or flight response. And that's a double-edged sword. Sometimes it works very well to, prepare us to flee or to fight. All the adrenaline starts to flow. But when that's what's the primary driving force, it can get in the way. You can be trying too hard. You can be running tight and tense. And you're running hard, but you're not running as efficiently as you might be able to, and therefore as fast as you're capable of, given your fitness and the condition. So all of that was eliminated by that cognitive shift in what I was about in that particular race. And it freed me up to have the kind of race I did. I mean, when I got to the finish line, I just stopped running because the race was over. I felt like I could have kept on running.
Wow.
But the point, back to your question of what did it do to me? How did it transform me? In the weeks and months after that, it turns out I went and ran the Olympic trials. I didn't make the team. I didn't have enough time to really recover. I would have had a better race at the trials if I had truly recovered from Boston. But I was so excited having won it, thinking that my chances of making the team were even not that much better. So I'm back. And before I was fully recovered, I started training hard again. And by the time I got to the trials, I was exhausted. So it became my own worst enemy. But it was interesting to observe how people responded to me after that. And you realize all of a sudden now you have a title. and how maybe it's always true. It was just a little more obvious to me that people interact with other people based on their titles quite often. You know, so we respond to what other people tend to represent. If we don't know, if we know them personally, it's different. Then we're responding to them and interacting with them as individuals. But if you don't know people, we respond to them by virtue of what their titles are, their roles. That's what celebrity is all about, right? You know, if you just meet some Joe Schmo in the street, it's, hi, Joe, how you doing? But if Joe happens to pitch for the Boston Red Sox, it's, oh my God, it's Joe, the pitcher, right? So, but it's the title. And so I had a title now all of a sudden. And I realized that's an interesting dynamic. And, but also what comes with that, just as what comes along, you know, the price of success is responsibility. And so in a sense, there's a responsibility to that title. And for me, you know, you can define what that means if you happen to be the holder of that. And for me, it was the responsibility was to do something with it and to share it as well. Some people like hearing the stories and kind of sharing that. What was it like? You and I are having a conversation about that right now. But some of the things that I had the opportunity to do and doors just opened for me, it wasn't like I tried to create these certain realities with what I'm doing now. You asked me earlier what I'm doing in terms of coaching these big fundraising teams, and they're raising millions and millions of dollars for cancer. I don't put a label on that I'm saving people from cancer, but it still gives meaning to that victory and to my larger running career by virtue of that. And just had the good fortune to be in the right place at the right time to make that happen. I like to think it would have happened in some other way had I been in different places at different times. But anyway, so those were the big changes that happened by virtue of that win.
And, you know, it's an excellent point. I love that mentality that you have. You know, you wanted to do something more with just the title, right? And now you're doing good and an amazing cause that you're supporting, which I love. And, you know, the title definitely carries some weight. I'm not going to lie. You know, Matthew, one of our other podcast guests said, hey, you want to meet the Jack Foltz, the winner of the 1976 Boston Marathon? And I said, of course I do. You know, so, you know, if he just said, I want to meet, you know, you want to interview my buddy Jack Foltz down the street, you know, it could have been a different conversation. We might not be talking tonight, but we are, thankfully.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, thankfully, we
so
are.
There you somewhere. Go. You validate my point.
Definitely. And, you know, I'm glad you are using your title for good, though. And I think that's the most important thing. You know, you're coaching people, you're helping them finish marathons, you're inspiring others, and you're sharing your story with everyone. So hats off to you there, Jack. Now, I am curious, Boston aside, you also ran and won the Newport Marathon. What's been your favorite marathon outside of Boston, if you had to pick one?
Well, I've had the opportunity again to run around the world. I ran New Zealand several times, the Honolulu Marathon many times. I've run in Europe and you know, around the States, all over the Continental 48 as well. And Newport probably was the most scenic marathon of all those beautiful places. The Newport Marathon, you run around Ocean Drive in Newport, Rhode Island. It's twice up and down Bellevue Avenue, which is where all the massive mansions are, the Rockefeller mansions and whatnot. It's easy to understand being in Newport, why they wanted to summer there as well. Their mansions, they call them cottages, but Ocean Drive is just absolutely beautiful. When you're in the midst of a race and you got your nose to the grindstone, you know, you're not really looking around, taking in the scenery typically, but it's so overwhelmingly beautiful. And I had been there before living up here in New England. I had a sense of it. I've since gotten to know Newport much, much better. We have a lot of good friends down there. I get down there on bike and we socialize and spend time there. But in that race, I didn't know it all that well as I do now. But the whole loop around Ocean Drive, you're along the ocean for 5 miles through that route. And we got to run that section twice. And it's just, you had to kind of keep telling yourself, pay attention to the race and not be gawking out at the beautiful seascape that you had and the crashing waves and the twists and turns. And it's just, it's a beautiful, beautiful place to run.
And, you know, that's an interesting point you bring up though, Jack, because I am curious, you know, for me, I'm going for PRs, maybe. I'm never going to win them, you know, any marathon race. My time is over 4 hours. So I am there to enjoy the scenery and take it all in. But as an elite runner, it sounds like you're really just grinding and looking straight ahead. Is that correct?
For the most part, you are. Yeah. Yeah. It's hard. But it's interesting. You know, we talked a little earlier. I mentioned earlier something about the cognitive structure that you set yourself up and you're getting ready for a race. And I found that sometimes it helps to relax, helps me stay relaxed or did when I was racing. If I would actually step back, take my nose off of the back of someone's shoulder, whoever I was following, and look around, look up, literally look up, look at the clouds, look at the landscape, take some deep breaths and help, it helps you stay relaxed and keeps things a little more in context, you know, because you can get, it's possible to get too focused. And then you just start, I mentioned earlier also, so you can start, you start to tighten up if you're, mm-hmm. if your focus is too intense and, you know, you're out there for 2, 3, 4 hours, whatever it is, it's a long time to be overly concentrating on one particular thing. So in sports psychology, which I taught for many, many years at Tufts University, we talk about this thing called cognitive association or cognitive disassociation. And they've actually done studies on elite level athletes versus more recreational athletes. And they determined actually that elite level athletes do a lot more cognitive association and more recreational athletes tend to disassociate. In other words, they'll distract themselves and it keeps their mind off of how tired you're starting to get. You know, you have a conversation with the person you're running next to, or you're looking around at different things and literally trying to distract yourself. And maybe you could do it with music. In the old days, there were no such thing as earbuds or portable music devices, but now everyone's doing it pretty much. And so that's another form of distraction, a positive distraction, I think. And so that whole idea of associating versus disassociating but before using music and stuff, I would find that I would intentionally force myself to disassociate, kind of look around, you know, whether it's taking in the scenery or whatever, and put my position, you know, all of a sudden it took my mind sense from thinking this is a life or death situation in this race to it's just another race, you know, and just that little added layer of relaxing would, you know, put me back in a better state of mind. And I'd find myself loosening up a little bit and my strides start to flow a little bit better. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm feeling less tired and a little, have a little, a better opportunity to be as competitive as I want to be. So
that's a great tip too, you know, for all of our listeners, I think out there, you know, it's up to you how you want to run, headphones, no headphones. You know, if you want to look around a little bit, that's okay too. So that's a good tip. Now I am curious, you said you ran a few international marathons. Any ones there that you want to highlight for our listeners that they should check out?
Well, Honolulu was great. It's in December, number one. So leaving New England or anywhere that there might be snow or cold and ice and going to Honolulu in December is a pretty good thing to do. And I had the good fortune again, the first year I ran that was also 1976. After not making the Olympic team through that fall, I trained and just got everything back together. And the next marathon I ran after the trials that summer was the Honolulu Marathon in December of 76. They invited me over as the winner of the Boston Marathon. And I ran the race. I think I got third. So I ran well. And I was funny. I was leading through about 21, 22 miles. And I was feeling pretty good at the time. And I'm wondering, what do they know that I don't know? Why are they letting me go? There was no one around me. And I'm wondering, I don't feel like I've gone out too fast, but maybe I have. And it was pretty warm over there as well. And sure enough, a local runner who was also an Olympian on the track, who I knew, Duncan McDonald, very, very good runner. Duncan came by me and he went by me so fast. I said, man, is he accelerating or am I decelerating? I'm not sure which, maybe both, but it was pretty quick. He said hello when he went by, but then one other friend came by. He wasn't a friend then. I didn't know him, but gotten to know the guy who passed me second. Anyway, I got third. And so I went back to Honolulu and ran the Honolulu Marathon many years after that. And to this day, now 50 years later, I was 40 Hawaii, who we go over to visit And so, you know, we planted some seeds in that very first year there that have led to having many positive, wonderful vacation times in Hawaii. So that's
a good recommendation for everyone.
Yeah, that definitely resonates. And I'm looking forward to going back to New Zealand too. New Zealand is an absolutely magical place. Sometimes on the travels I would go to, I would simply go to run the race, be there for a long weekend, and I would leave. And then after a while, I realized I'm going to some of these nice places, but I'm not taking advantage of them. So when I went to New Zealand, the two times I went, two straight years, I did. After the first year, I spent 2 weeks hitchhiking around the South Island. While I was recovering from the marathon, I was having a great time doing hiking and trekking. And the second year, I went up and explored the Bay of Islands up top the north part of the North Island. And I have friends in New Zealand through the marathoning world. I would bring a lot of New Zealand runners in when I was working for the Boston Marathon with elite athletes. So they keep saying, come on back down. There's still a lot of New Zealand to see. So it's only a matter of time before I get back there as well. So
it's definitely on my bucket list. And, you know, a lot of our guests have said marathons are just a great way to see the world and to run around cities and really just, you know, check out your surroundings. And then like you did, make it a trip, you know, take a week or two and just really enjoy the land that you're running on and check it all out.
If there's anything I could encourage people wanting to run marathons, it would be do that, you know, pick your favorite ones. Maybe you want to run Boston or New York. They're harder to get into. Boston, you have to qualify for or run on a charity team. And that's a big fundraising commitment. A lot of the other marathons, each of the marathons select their field in different ways. Some of them do it on lottery. Most of them now have a charity team that if you're willing to raise money for one of the charity teams, like our Dana-Farber team, and you promise to raise enough money for them, you can get on those teams. And those are good ways to do it. But and I know people who've run Boston many, many times, and at the expense of running other marathons, other places. And I would encourage people to kind of spread your wings, you know, go run Paris and London and Honolulu, New Zealand, Australia. I mean, you can use it as a ticket to really see the world. And if you're going to do that, probably my recommendation would be to show up just shortly before the race, run the race and get that out of the way. And then do all your vacation time afterwards rather than the other way around. So
more on the recovery side.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely. So now you're a big coach now. You're coaching hundreds of people at the Dana-Farber Institute. We haven't had a lot of coaches on the podcast. So I am curious, you know, for beginners maybe or people just starting to marathon that, you know, are listening to the podcast, what are some training recommendations that you have or, you know, maybe a few quick tips you could sort of shed your wisdom on?
Sure. Well, I'm a real advocate of cross training. Actually now. So to not overrun, most runners sustain their injuries from running and running too much, either doing too much too soon, increasing your mileage too quickly, coming back from a little bit of a setback, an illness or a minor injury that slows you down. And you feel like you have to catch back up to the training program. So you accelerate and re-injure yourself, something like that. Or you keep trying to catch up, or you're keeping up with a training program that's scripted out for you online or that your coach maybe gave you. Well, someone's working with a coach one-on-one, the coach will modify something if they see that you're overtraining, trying to keep up with a program. But a lot of people use online training programs, for example, and there's never one size fits all. You know, when in doubt, less is more. So you start getting a little bit extra tired. I mean, you're going to get tired. Training for a marathon does that to us. But if it becomes a little bit of a chronic thing, you find yourself 3, 4, 5 days, a whole week where you're tired, you're enthusiasm for running, for tying the shoes on and getting out the door is starting to wane and you're battling that. Certainly having training partners helps with that component. But if you had your friends that you had to meet, even if you're retired, you'd go out and do it. And it may not be the wisest thing to do. So again, when in doubt, less is more. Incorporate a lot of cross training. Now, cross training has a wide definition to it. If you're running 3 or 4 days a week, that's all you really need to prepare for a marathon and to prepare for a good, even a faster marathon. I know people who are running in the low threes who run only 4 days a week, but of the other 3 days, or maybe even all three, you might do something like an hour on the elliptical machine. You certainly incorporate a lot of body strength work and flexibility work. Train like you're a good general athlete and then specializing. We happen to be specializing in running. It could be specializing in biking or rowing or swimming or something like that. Those people tend to do those activities almost at the exclusion of anything else. And you can do that on a bike or in a pool or in a boat if you're rowing, because you don't have the impact. And it's the impact of pounding on the roads that most runners sustain the majority of their injuries from. And so, you know, form follows function. If you're, let's say, if you're injured and you couldn't run because of a sore Achilles tendon or a sore iliotibial band or something like that, and it was the impact that was bothering you, you could jump on a good elliptical machine. Cybex makes a great one called the Arc Trainer that really, with the right settings, can effectively simulate the neuromuscular firing pattern of running. So, you know, if you need a good video because you'll fry your brain if you're on that thing for an hour and a half or 2 hours wailing away, but that's a good way to do it. But you can get on it for shorter periods of time and do higher quality workouts and do an interval type workout on a machine like that. And you come away, you might feel a little tired, but you wake up the next morning and you don't feel like you did that kind of a hard road banging workout. And so incorporating a lot of cross training into what you're doing, I think is really valuable. So that would probably be number one. And have a plan. Really have a good sense of where you're going. Don't do it in an ad hoc manner. And most people do now. There's so many online programs. Most people who start training for a marathon, they're either members of a local running club or they're on a charity team. They have some kind of guidance, even if they're doing it for their first or second time and don't know. And most of the advice out there is, you know, as Billy Joel said, advice is cheap. You can take it from me, right? But there's good advice out there. A lot of experienced runners giving advice on what to do, what not to do, what to avoid. But I think, as I mentioned earlier, some of the common mistakes are doing too much too soon, trying to ramp the program up. One unit of overdoing it is equivalent to 2 units of underdoing it. So, you know, that's related to that notion that I said earlier, that when in doubt, less is more. If you're not sure if you should go out for a run, if you're having a mental conversation with yourself that, I don't know, you know, my knee kind of hurts. I really want to go, but I'm not so sure. It's been bothering me for 3 days now. You know, it's the workout that pushes you over the edge and then costs you 2 weeks of recovery is far worse than simply missing a workout that you might not have needed to. You know, you're not going to lose much fitness, but you'll live to fight another day.
That's a great tip.
Those are some of the general, I think, tips that I would give anybody coming into it.
Awesome. And how about signs on the course? I'm curious. This is one of my favorite parts about marathon running, seeing different signs out there. I'm curious, maybe in 1976 in Boston, besides hoses, if there were any signs there or any sort of favorite signs you've seen out on the course.
Well, there are always signs at Wellesley at Boston, which is the halfway mark, but Wellesley College is an all-girls school. Now they've only allowed them on one side of the road. They've closed off. But back in the early days, it was called the Scream Tunnel, because the young co-eds were on both sides of the road when you're running past campus. And the screen, you can hear it a half mile before you get there. They're all screaming like crazy, and they're all holding up big signs. A lot of them, kiss me or marry me or, you know, whatever it is. It was very flat. And this is back in the days when women weren't running the marathon. They're still out there today. So the signs that they hold are much broader in scope, so to speak. It's not just young girls pretending like they want some guy who's running the marathon to stop and kiss them, but those are there for sure. So those are kind of cute and novel, but they're an integral part of the Boston Marathon. There's another sign at Boston, and you see it on t-shirts now. It's called right on Hereford, left on Boylston. And those are the last two turns of the Boston Marathon. You're on Calm Avenue for the last 4 miles, and then you get up and you're within about a half a mile of the finish line. You make a right-hand turn on a small street in Boston. It's called Hereford Street. Hereford. So that you're right on Hereford, you go around two blocks, and then you turn left, and then you're on Boylston Street. And that's the street that the finish line's on. And it used to be, once you got on Boylston, you had to actually run over Boylston Street, and you had a little short stretch, and the finish line was there. Since 1986, when John Hancock took over as the primary sponsor, they restructured the course a little bit. They moved the finish line down in front of the John Hancock Tower, instead of the Prudential, their competitive company, the Prudential Tower. And And so you have a 600 meter stretch on Boylston Street. So the sign says right on Hereford, left on Boylston. And you'll see that on t-shirts and banners and posters and stuff around the Boston Marathon. So you say that to anybody who's ever run Boston, they'll know immediately what you're talking about. Or those who simply are hoping to run Boston, they'll all know that. That'll be me. Yeah, so there you go. So in terms of other signs, no, you don't see too many political signs out there, which is a little surprising, actually, I suppose, given the political landscape of today. But nothing else particularly really comes to mind. There's always the mileage markers, if you call them signs, on the road. You know, obviously, every marathon now has each mile mark, each 5K mark, and then at Boston, they have 1 mile to go as well. And I think most marathons probably have that now as well. So, and it's right in Kenmore Square, and it's, 2 years after my win was the year I ran my PR at Boston, and I was stuck behind the press bus, passed it 3 times, and it passed me twice, coming down the last 3 miles on Comm Ave, and I got out in front of it just before that 1 mile to go mark. So I still remember that whole episode whenever I drive through the Kenmore Square area now in Boston. And you can still see this, the roadside, they slowly wear out over the course of the year, and then they repaint them the week before the marathon, so they're bright and fresh. But so anyway.
I love that. Awesome. All right. Well, this has been an amazing interview, Jack. Thank you so much for joining us. I did want to wrap up with one last question. The podcast is called Why We Marathon.
Yeah.
In just 2 to 3 sentences, can you sort of sum up the crux of why you run marathon races?
Well, I guess what comes to mind is, why do mountain climbers climb mountains? And the standard answer for them is because it's there. And I suppose to some degree, you could say that also for the marathon, because it's there. And the word marathon itself is now a generic term for anything that is grand, very grand in scale, monumental in scale. And we have to go above and beyond ourselves, way outside of our comfort zones, and do things that we never thought we possibly could to be able to achieve those marathon-esque experiences. And for us runners, it's truly and literally a marathon, right? So the rest of the world has now borrowed the name of our event to represent these really larger than life grand experiences. And so a marathon's not something you just go out and do one day. It's maybe some crazy college kids can do that on a drunken bet, but it usually consumes every day of your life for 4 to 6 months, from the time you start thinking about it to the time you finally get entered and then get into your program. Most training programs are 18 to 20 weeks long, some even longer. And even the days you're not working out, you're thinking about your next workout. So we have thousands of testimonials of people who have done this, people running their first marathons, people who are running their 25th marathon. It's still, every one of them share that common experience that it really consumes your life, for better, for worse. And, so you kind of have to be prepared for that. And of course, people running on our Dana-Farber team or any of these charitable fundraising causes, they have that on top of just the training itself, the reason why they're doing it, their real raison d'etre. And, but it's because of that, it has been very empowering for these people, because they feel like they don't have a way to fight back the disease or the plight for which they're raising money now. They feel emboldened and empowered because of that. And I think the marathoning experience itself, the nomenclature and the actual physical act of doing it, I think just, it forces people to go above and beyond what they may have thought that they were capable of prior to that. And, a lot of our first timers will come to me, and one of the first things they say is, I'm not a runner. And I said, you're on a marathon team now. You are by definition a runner. So they kind of have to change their own conversation about where they fit into the whole scheme of things as well. And then coming out the back door after they run the marathon, I think that's one of the very enriching experiences as well, as people just, wow, I really didn't think I could do it when I first stepped into this thing. I'd never run more than 3 or 4 miles. And the idea of being able to run 20 was anathema to them. I said, you don't have to think about running 20 miles. If you run 4, next week we'll think about running 5. and then 6 and 8 and then 10, and you inch your way back up to that. And then that also provides a nice model for taking on other big grand events in one's life. As you map it out, give yourself enough time to have a plan and do it in a step-by-step measured way. And all of a sudden you can get to the mountaintop. So
I absolutely love that, Jack. Your mentality, your approach, your support for the community and for the Dana-Farber Institute is just incredible. Obviously winning Boston in 76, legendary. So thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Alex, thanks a million for having me. It's been a lot of fun, and good luck to you and your next upcoming marathon. We'll talk more offline about that and help you get ready for it again. But again, thanks a million for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Definitely. Thank you, Jack. And for all of our listeners out there, thanks for listening. Follow us on Instagram at Why We Marathon and visit our website, www.whywemarathon.com, to see additional stories, photos, and recaps of each episode. And please rate and review our podcast and share your episodes with your friends and family. Thank you again today for joining us, Jack. I really enjoyed your story. And I hope all of our listeners out there enjoyed not only Jack's story, but all of these stories of amazing human perseverance. So thank you again for listening to Why We Marathon.